Dad's right.
Are you with him on this?
He sees everything, Shiv.
You have a hard time finding a happy medium between worshiping him and wanting to kill him.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to The Sweet Smell of Succession, an unofficial recap podcast about the HBO original series Succession. I'm David Chen, and joining me right now, she is the editor-at-large at Primetimer.com and the co-host of Extra Hot Great, Tara Ariano. How are you doing today?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm doing well. And I have a question for you. Have you ever gotten a theme park or a restaurant or any place shut down to celebrate your birthday?
I'm trying to think. No, never. No. Not even a restaurant. And sometimes that's not that hard.
Yeah.
Lots of places that do catering, they will do that. But no, I don't think I ever have. Have you?
I haven't done that before. It does look like it would be cool. I mean, I guess the only thing I can think of is like a wedding, right? Like my wedding.
Right, right.
You know,
sure.
You shut down like a floor of a restaurant for something. But it certainly does look like it would be cool unless your dad is really strung out and extremely demoralized by his family's machinations. Other than that, seems like it'd be a cool experience. Anyway, welcome to this podcast where every episode we recap an episode of Succession. This week, we're recapping season 2, episode 2, entitled Valter. Before we begin, I just want to mention you can find more episodes of the show at successionpodcast.com. You can find us on Twitter at successionpod and email us at successionpodcast@gmail.com. And you know, Tara, it was so much time since we launched our Kickstarter and when the first episode of Succession Season 2 debuted, we totally spaced on thanking all the people who donated it to our Kickstarter at successionkickstarter.com.
So careless, but thank you. Thank you to everyone who did.
Yes.
Wonderful.
Indeed. And starting in this episode and or next episode, we will be reading your names in appreciation of all that you've done. And it was very heartwarming because there was a bunch of people whose names I had recognized on the donor list from people in our lives, Tara, but also people who've just been fans of ours for a while who decided to contribute there. So you're all awesome, and the support means a lot. So we really appreciate you. Anyway.
Yes, we do. Thank you so much.
So let's get into this week's episode, Season 2, Episode 2, Valter. As I mentioned, this episode begins at a theme park that's been shut down for Kendall's daughter's birthday. And kind of an interesting scene. Like, this scene is very much disconnected from the rest of the episode in the sense that, like, usually we're in, like, the Roy's house or at Waystar Royko's offices. But here you get to see Kendall having fun for once, right?
Kendall is having the time of his life.
He's
moping around. He cannot even, you know, put on a brave face, fake it till he makes it for the sake of his daughter having a good birthday. Although she doesn't seem to notice. She just wants a train to go faster and goes and hugs him and thank him when he asks an employee to speed it up. And Roman notices that he doesn't even lift up his arms to hug her back and later calls Kendall a broken robot. Mm. And he would probably be happier if he were a robot, but he definitely is broken. That is for sure. A
couple of other fun little tidbits in the opening sequence at the theme park. One of them is that we find out Greg is looking for a place to live. And I think Mila offers him a place with one of her friends that might have spores.
Like, yeah.
So can he handle spores? And of course, this is a reference to the eternal battle of anyone trying to find affordable housing in New York City.
Oh, my God. Yes.
I can't even imagine. Has New York City been a place you've attempted to live in the past?
Oh, yeah. But I've never tried to rent there. But we did have a condo. And that was a whole other set of nightmares. But we did look at place. I mean, we will later see a little bit of Greg's apartment hunt, and they do show him a place where the bedroom is on a separate like a half a floor. There's a loft and he can barely like stand up in it to even get into bed, and the real estate agent doesn't care. He just keeps talking about the storage, and Greg is like, what I mostly need to store here is me. Like, he just doesn't understand that this isn't going to work. But yeah, finding apartments in New York is hard. Affordable is like a very changeable term depending on when you're looking. So yeah,
I remember a Gawker story about this woman who lived like in this tiny closet where she basically had a sleeping area the same as Greg in that apartment he sees in this episode.
Yeah.
And she talked about having panic attacks all the time because like the ceiling is so close to your face, you know?
Yeah.
So yes. Anyway, it seems like a rough place to live if you are not a billionaire. Let's just put it that way.
Yeah, well, this is, I mean, Connor has no concept of what Greg is going through and just says, well, why don't you just live in a hotel? And yeah. Greg is like, like on a nightly basis? Because that's what Connor has decided to do. He has left Austerlitz, his estate in New Mexico, and is just living in a gigantic palatial hotel suite that we see while he's figuring out his presidential campaign, because that's still happening.
Against Tara's wishes, unfortunately, but
yes, very much against my wishes.
But let's dive into the rest of the episode. A lot happens in this episode, and I'm really keen to hear your perspective on this as somebody who has worked in digital media before. So,
oh God, yeah.
Let's get into it, shall we?
Sure. So everyone is at the park for this birthday party when they are all summoned to whatever holding pen Logan is in when he's no surprise to anyone not riding rides. He's watching cable news because the proxy war over Waystar has begun, with Stewie going on a finance show on rival news network PGM to cast doubts on Logan's fitness as CEO, dismiss Kendall as irrelevant, and specifically call Kendall out for having overpaid for Valter. Roman notices Shiv is the one crafting a defense strategy and that Logan runs with her aggressive stance. And that's not the only place that Shiv is dominant in this episode. Tom has come around on the idea of an open marriage, and Shiv is successfully sidelining Nate in her on the Gillievous campaign. Shiv also may have told one of their coworkers about the affair that she and Nate had. Nate hopes she didn't, since he didn't tell his wife, but since Shiv did tell Tom, she doesn't care if her candor makes things awkward for Nate and cares even less when Gil lets her know he has her in mind for his White House chief of staff.
So a couple of things I want to mention about this. One of them is that I realized, thinking back on this episode, there was this moment when Shiv is invited into the inner circle to help craft the defense. And Roman says something like, hey, Shiv, you know, like noticing her there.
Yeah.
But it just like I've worked in many corporate environments, and sometimes it happens where somebody shows up to a work meeting where you have no idea why they are there.
Yeah.
And most of the time, people's reaction is just to say nothing about it, right? Because, like, people will not risk awkwardness if it's unnecessary, especially if there's important people around. But I like that Roman is the one to kind of pierce the awkwardness a little bit. And even he doesn't do it full-throated. He just is like, hey, like, what's happening here? And it just, like, mostly goes unacknowledged, right?
Yes. Well, we'll find out later that he has misread why she's involved, but yeah.
Yeah. You're talking about Shiv mistreating Nate greatly in this episode. I mean, she's just completely brutal to him now.
I don't think I said she mistreats him. she's not nice to him. Yeah,
treats him as he should be treated.
Yes. Is this what he deserves? I don't know. People can disagree on that, I guess.
Fair enough. And then Gillievous offers her chief of staff. Curious, she had this kind of inscrutable look on her face when he did that. And what did you make of it? I felt it could have either been she's very happy at getting offered this very prestigious role in the future White House, or it pales in comparison to this other job she might have running Waystar Royco. What do you think?
I thought that was her thinking, wow, I have two amazing opportunities.
Yeah.
And I need to figure out what I'm going to do, because we later see her go and check in with Logan just to make sure, is this actually real? Because I mean, to me, that was her thinking, I better firm up Waystar in order to make the choice between them.
Yeah.
What did you think?
Yeah. I mean, I think it could be, I couldn't figure it out. I couldn't it's a great look that she has. Cause I couldn't figure it out. Cause I'm thinking if I were her, running, I just think being CEO of a large company is in general like a very kind of life-changing position, right? Like, and sure, chief of staff of a president is also very life-changing, but it does feel to me as though anyone who feels like they have good leadership skills would rather be running the show than reporting to someone who's running the show. Like, I just feel that in my bones. And so I feel like she's just, my assessment is where I lean on that look is that she's more thinking, hey, this is the best I can do in this situation as chief of staff.
Interesting.
Yeah, I better like circle the wagons on this other Logan Roy opportunity. Unsure.
I mean, presumably, I feel like we don't have a good handle on what Shiv's principles are, if she has any, really.
Yeah.
We do know that if she got into politics, it's because she's interested in power and acquiring more of it for herself. And definitely, if you were anyone who is in the position that Shiv is in this campaign, like chief of staff is what they're probably all angling for. So that look may just be, oh, shit, I have eclipsed Nate.
Yeah.
I bested him. And yeah, you're right. It may be that all she needs for her to be done with this part of her career is to just like know that she did that.
Right. Yeah.
And then be like, well, at least I know I sold it up. Now it doesn't even matter if I actually do it.
Right. Right. Indeed. So what happens next in the episode?
All right. Well, though he had wanted to get into the entertainment arm of the company, Tom is trying to make the best of his new job in news and trying even harder to dismiss Greg's qualms about having joined him there at ATN.
Being in at ATN, you know, it's kind of like the one thing I didn't want to do.
Oh, okay. So should I have left you at Parks to sink? I mean, it's ATN, man. It's the fucking news.
I know.
It's Logan's G-spot. I can finger bang him all night long. I'm a direct report. What?
Sure, just ATN, it's like kind of against my principles.
Your principles? Craig, don't be an asshole. You don't have principles.
Dude, ATN is a very toxic element in the culture.
Seriously, okay, name me one principle that you have.
I don't know, like I'm against racism.
Bullshit, I'm against racism. Everybody's against racism. What else?
Like, don't lie.
Fuck off.
Like, if you're the news,
fuck
like
off. Hey, that's your principle?
Yeah, dude.
Greg, this is not fucking Charles Dickens world, okay? You don't go around talking about principles. We're all trying to do the right thing. Of course we are. But come on, man. Man the fuck up.
The executive above Tom at ATN can tell that Tom doesn't share the network's news values, but hotly denies that Logan sets their editorial agenda. She also tells Tom that Logan sends someone like him over every 4 years, so presumably not a raging conservative. Tom points out that none of the others has been a son-in-law, but she seems confident that he will flame out. Amazingly, though, Greg actually does fulfill Tom's demand that he find fat at ATN that Tom can cut. Production is still analog, involving a facility in Queens still dealing with physical media, and digitizing will mean that Tom can lay off 50 skulls, as he sensitively puts it.
Yeah, I mean, I think this whole sequence of Tom trying to figure out how to jockey for a better position and get some skulls on the board, as it were, was really kind of troubling, you know, because the idea that's being put forward here is that cutting costs and like impacting people's lives is very often the result of political gamesmanship within a company, right? That is all it is, and it's not about like anything else. And
that's called capitalism.
Yeah, fair enough, Tara. But I guess again, having worked in many corporate environments, I think there is this desire that we all have to want to feel like that people, when they make these decisions, they're with good intentions, right?
Oh, that, you know, that's adorable.
All right. Fair enough.
Yeah. I mean, of course, like the point, the way that if you're in this environment, you're trying to maximize value for shareholders. I'm not saying this is right. I'm saying if you have chosen this as your path,
it's not even maximizing shareholder value though. It's more like he just needs to show he can get stuff done so that he looks good. You know what I mean?
Right. And that too.
I can actually even get on board with the shareholder value maximization. It's like more like this is just like solely so I look good. So I look better.
Yeah, of course.
So I set my own career up, you know, good for the future.
Yes. Cutting 50 salaries is not going to make really much of a difference on the bottom line.
Yeah.
You're right. This is just primarily to put a win on the board as Tom perceives what it means to win so that it looks like he's doing something.
Yeah. And I mean, you really see Tom's true colors in this episode of like that. That is what he's willing to do. He's I think mm-hmm. we all knew that he was very much of a ladder climber, but the ruthlessness that is required is getting higher and higher as the show goes on. So,
yeah, but I think it's easier for Tom to do that when these are people that he like doesn't know and has never seen their faces. Like he doesn't care. Tom strikes me as someone who, if he was ever in an undercover boss situation, like if would be much more soft-hearted and would find it harder to make choices like this if he actually had any kind of like human to human connection with the people that he's doing this to.
Fair enough. He's complex.
I might be giving him too much credit.
we'll find out, I think, as the show goes on. This episode is called Vulture. And I think, Tara, you had made some predictions about how and whether Vulture might be involved with the main plotline this season. Of course, it intersects the main plotline in a big way this episode. What happens with Vulture?
Oh, Vulture. Well, Stu, just to backtrack before we get into Vulture, though, you noted that Greg is the one who identifies where to cut this fat in terms of digitizing. And the fact that this hasn't been done yet in whatever year this is supposed to be, let's say 2019, makes me think there are implications to making this change that they can't predict because they have just parachuted into this business and don't know enough about it. And so I'm curious to see if there's going to be unintended bad consequences is going to slow things down at ATN because they've made this change without really knowing what they're doing.
Yeah, I mean, I think when Greg is dictating your human capital policies, you might end up in a bad situation. I think that's a very reasonable prediction. So
yes. All right, back to Vulture. So Stewie, having alerted him to a possible issue there, Logan sends Kendall and Roman to investigate. Lawrence, our hero, still disdains Kendall and knows all about his recent, extremely brief trip to rehab. He is justly suspicious about the Waystar delegation descending upon his offices and Kendall's reassurances about that fall flat.
There's just a lot of crackle in the air right now. External pressures with the proxy battle, that whole...
So you're defusing the bomb you planted?
Yes, precisely. See? He gets it. He sees.
So while they're having this meeting, we can see behind Roman's head, like there's a screen that's displaying trending Vulture stories.
Yes.
And we just see bits of it. There's something about like you see Taylor Swift and feminist or whatever, or maybe misogynist. But the only one that we can read in its entirety on the screen behind Roman is 5 reasons why drinking milk on the toilet is kind of a game changer.
Amazing headline. Amazing headline.
Yes, it really places this episode in time. Like when the aliens find this after we've all, you know, been swallowed by the seas 15 years from now, they're going to look at this document and say, oh, yes, of course, 2019.
This is the point on Idiocracy that they were, this is the point in time on Idiocracy that they were on, that the human race was on before its own annihilation. But
we laughed to keep from crying. Yes.
That was an amazing headline. And I think it's funny because what it reinforces to me is that, yes, many elements of Succession are firmly rooted in real life. But, I recently read this article in The Hollywood Reporter writing up season 2 by Seth Abramovich. And one thing that was very important to them was that the references not be too direct, like the analogs not be too specific.
Right.
Like they wanted it to be general enough that it's kind of this like vague other world, other alternate universe that you're looking in. So yes, there are many similarities to the Murdochs, but they're not direct analogs. Similarly, I don't think Gawker would ever publish a 5 Reasons Why Drinking Milk on the Toilet is Kind of a Game Changer article. So like, I think we can assume that Gawker, or I should say Vulture, is kind of this amalgamation of like BuzzFeed and Gawker and Upworthy and all these other sites, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Yes. So Lawrence orders one of his employees to bury Kendall in paper. Roman, not so much for reading, has come up with one idea on his own.
One idea? Pivot to video?
Oh, the pivot to video. This to me is like, it's so such an insider reference. Like, I don't know if anyone watching this episode who doesn't work in media is going to get why that is so grimly, grimly funny. But wow.
Yeah. So, let's explain for those who might be listening to this, who might not be in digital media, right? That yes. basically, like, you know, I'll give it a shot and then you correct me if I miss anything, Tara. But basically,
you probably know more than I do, but go ahead.
A lot of online websites, mm-hmm. a lot of websites that publish things, you know, news articles, feature stories, etc. Many of them are venture funded, right? And so yes. at some point in the last 5 years, that venture funding ran out for a variety of reasons, and they were unable to replenish it because Facebook changed their algorithm, because yep. ad rates plummeted, because of any of a variety of reasons. And so
Facebook, by the way, just to interrupt you, Facebook changing its algorithm is also mentioned by Lawrence yes. as a reason that some of their numbers looked soft, but that they're getting back on track. This is a real thing. Proceed.
Did he give a real, I think the term he used was like face fucked
yes.
was the term he gave to it, which I thought was very good.
Yeah.
So at that point, like, these publications were left without much recourse. And so many of them did something called, quote unquote, pivoting to video. And the idea mm-hmm. was that Facebook video was growing rapidly. Like, Facebook was de-emphasizing written content and emphasizing video. Like, they're surfacing video everywhere. They're making your notifications into videos. And so for many websites, they're like, okay, well, Facebook's not doing our written stuff anymore, but they're cranking up the algorithm on video. And so maybe if we pivot to video, that'll get us back into Facebook's good graces, and we'll be fine. Mm-hmm. And then eventually, like, many of those websites then failed after the pivot to video as well.
Yes.
Which is also referenced.
Yes, this happened
episode.
To people that I knew who worked at Mike.com,
yeah.
M-I-C, which they then pivoted back. I'm not sure what their status is at this point.
Yeah.
But this also happened to a huge team of people that I knew who had all, when Grantland went under, the ESPN sort of culture site that was run by Bill Simmons, when ESPN shuttered that site, a bunch of them all went to work at MTV.com.
Yeah.
And MTV obviously is not run by venture. We know that. But they are a huge media company like Waystar Royco. And so that happened to them as well, that a whole bunch of their writers all got laid off because they were pivoting to video. And I know Facebook is part of it, but I thought it was also partly that you could get higher CPMs. At higher rates for people outside of media for ads on videos versus ads that are in written content online.
Problem with pivoting to video that many sites then eventually came to realize is that it takes a lot of time and effort to make video that people want to watch.
Yes.
Like high quality video. And so, like, many of those pivots to video failed. And
yes.
it's indicated in this episode that, like, Valter's pivot to video failed as well.
Right, yes. Roman says that's his idea, and Jerry said they tried that.
Yeah.
Yeah. The thing that these people forget when they're doing the pivot to video is that, like, people are reading your content at work. Like, they don't all have headphones on at their desks. They don't want to be seen watching a video. Like, they have to give plausible deniability that they are still doing work. And if it looks like they're reading text, then they have that, you know?
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it's, you know, whatever. This is a real thing that happens. So
it ended up being, like, a huge mess, like, basically twice, right? First, when, like, many of the layoffs happened, and then the pivot to video. And then when mm-hmm. the pivot to video failed, like, another round of layoff. And so, like, it's basically right. been, like, a bloodbath in digital publishing over the course that we've been watching it over the last few years occur.
Yes. But then there's also the bad PR of it too, that even when they pivot back and are like, no, now we're hiring editors, it's like, well, you're radioactive. No one would want to work for you because you seem like scabs. You know what I mean? Like, it's hard then to recover that goodwill.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, so, I know that definitely happened at MTV, but anyway,
it's a huge mess. And I'm curious, like, overall, Tara, you know, as mm-hmm. somebody who knows people in digital media and, like, who's yeah. been in it yourself, like, how did you feel about its depiction in this episode, like, that these dynamics were at play? Like, because the way it's depicted in the episode, it's not like, oh, the headwinds of the plummeting digital media market are impacting us. It's mostly just, hey, like, a political game between Roman and Kendall that's resulting in what happens with Valter, right?
And yeah, so, like, I mean, I, of yeah. course, have in companies that I've worked with, which it's has not been much. I've been mostly self-employed for my career, but it, you know, I'm never privy to those very, very, very high level power shifts, of course. But if it is this I know from other stories, and we'll get to them, but that it is sometimes just that mercutial, like it's just someone's whim on a given day.
Yeah. Yeah.
So anyway, so what happens here, getting back to this episode, is when both brothers reconvene to report their findings to Logan, Kendall is optimistic. Walter is somewhat messy, but he thinks that if they just throw $50 million at it for a few years, Walter could be Royko's lodestar. Roman disagrees, not just because he is contemptuous of their non-dairy milks and beehive and muesli, but because he took some staffers out for drinks and found out they're looking to unionize soon. Now, this is definitely something that is happening increasingly in across written media for all of these reasons, just because there is so much precarity in the industry right now that lots and lots of workplaces where people do writing are looking to join the WGA, the Writers Guild of America, in order to protect their jobs from these kinds of impulsive decisions, which is why, I mean, that part is real for sure. But I do not buy that, first of all, the staffers would go out with Roman, someone in his position, and then while out with him, tell him about the unionization plans.
Mm. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I think it's meant to be an indication of how effectively Roman can portray himself as the black sheep. But
maybe,
Yeah, I think you're probably right that they probably would be pretty sensitive about that.
Yeah. Although it's possible that, you know, this is the first he's hearing about it, but that it has been public, because that's definitely been the case with a lot of organizations. BuzzFeed News, their union effort has been very public in reminding people how long it took for the organization to like even recognize their union. So it may be that they assumed he knew, and then he's presenting this as brand new information. It's like, yeah, no, we read Twitter. We are aware.
I think the Roman Kendall battle is really interesting this episode, because you really get to see their two styles at play, right? And yeah, going up against each other. So I think it's actually a pretty interesting conflict that this episode introduces. What happens next with Roman and Kendall and Walter?
So Roman thinks they should shut Walter down. Kendall thinks that in the midst of a proxy war, this will make Waystar look weak. Roman thinks they'll look ruthless, and Logan agrees with him. And Kendall immediately folds because he has no leverage in this relationship anymore. And Logan rewards Kendall's loyalty by making him the one who has to shut Walter down. His baby acquisition that he worked so hard to lock down, as we saw in the series premiere.
Yeah.
And Kendall does so, starting by assuring employees that they don't need a union because they're part of the Waystar family, and inviting them to brainstorm content and business ideas for him.
One of the most unrealistic things I felt about this episode was that, like, I think if Kendall made that speech, that first speech, it would have been recorded and leaked online. I mean, I just think that that's happened so often in it was particularly digital media workplaces, mm-hmm, where people are used to dealing with confidential information and leaking it, I just don't think it would have been contained. I understand that in the narrative of the show, it doesn't make sense for it to be leaked, because you find out that it's ultimately a ruse that Kendall is pulling, right?
Yep.
That struck me as mildly unrealistic. Anyway, continue.
Yeah, I agree. That is weird. So Kendall then sets up a shadow office under dark of night and unceremoniously fires everyone. And by the way, setting up a shadow office is something that really happened during a union fight at the LA Times, where they like set up a whole other floor that was going to basically restaff everyone that they were planning to fire during the union stuff. This was a couple years ago now. It's all by the book media industry workers have become too familiar with over the past 10 years. And my heart goes out to everyone who's been triggered by watching this. Not a joke. This shit is brutal. One of the things that happens for all of the Walter employees is that they come in and Kendall has to get up and give another speech and say, you've noticed the servers are down. And that's exactly what happened when I and everyone I worked with got laid off from Yahoo, and some of the people who were in that team knew and had to like continue pretending that stuff was getting fixed because they weren't in a position where they could announce it to anyone yet. I happened to be on vacation that week, so I missed most of this drama. But again, this is media playbook, and it is not kind to workers, and it's rough, real rough to watch.
Yeah, this felt like a particularly brutal instance of it. Like, I don't know. So I have been at a company that has experienced layoffs before.
Yeah.
And it was no one's happy with how it goes down, But this looked like particularly brutal, right? Like this just like a mass announcement, extremely cold by somebody who you don't like, you know, like it felt particularly brutal. But it, according to you, like this very much fits with what your actual experiences have been. Like it's it feels like true to life in terms of how it went down.
Yeah. I mean, I could list all of the various, you know, bad PR media stories that this storyline is put together from. Like, you know, there's elements of Gawker, there's elements of Mike and Yahoo and Gothamist and so on and so on and so on. Like it just keeps happening. So there was definitely a lot of material for them to craft this storyline from, sadly.
One of the things you pointed out in our conversation about season one was you had mentioned how you had conceived potentially of Lawrence as being Kendall's antagonist for season one. And we kind of talked a little bit about whether or not he was an effective one, right? Because it really felt like season one, episode one and two were really setting Lawrence up to be kind of a big bad, as it were, to Kendall's wishes. And I thought back to our conversation this episode because we see Kendall's final confrontation with Lawrence.
Hey! Kendall, what the fuck are you doing?
The fuck is going on?
Yeah, sorry about the cloak and dagger. I just needed some time to untangle all your shit, find the profit centers, keep the union off our back. We're already fully operational on 7.
Why?
Because my dad told me to.
Because your dad told you to? Jesus Christ. Because your dad told you to? You fucked it, bro.
Uh-huh. Go find some other chicken coop, cunt.
But are you fucking kidding me? Because your dad told you to? Are you a fucking idiot? Kendall!
He tells him off. It's a very effective little scene, but I did feel like it was a bit of a missed opportunity. If we had gotten a little bit more information on Lawrence, or if we had learned more about Lawrence's plans to shut Kendall down, I feel like this final moment with Kendall, I guess, triumphing, question mark, would have been even more effective. What do you think?
Yeah, I agree. It's I agree that Lawrence was a character with a huge amount of potential that didn't really get realized, which is what also makes me wonder, not just because I want to stick with my prediction. Obviously now we know Vulture is not going to be the outlet that breaks Kendall's manslaughter scandal if that happens, but that doesn't necessarily mean that Lawrence couldn't still be leaked to, especially now that anyone who would be leaking would know that he has an axe to grind against Kendall personally. And he could take it to another outlet. But yeah, I think Lawrence is such a good character, and the dynamic between him and Kendall is fascinating to watch, because he knows Kendall is bullshit.
Yeah.
And Kendall knows he sees right through him.
Yeah.
And Lawrence makes no bones about it. Like, he's very open in letting Kendall know that he, how much contempt he has for him. And so for this to be, if this really is the end for the two of them, it'll be a shame, because they had good rival chemistry.
Yeah. Yeah. One of the things I think is really funny about the show, by the way, is how Kendall changes the way he talks when he's around Lawrence and Vulture. You know, he'll try to use more of the street lingo, like, hey man, what's up? You know, oh, that shit is whack. You know, like he'll try to talk like he belongs in that environment, and he clearly doesn't. And I think that's like what's code switching but done crappily, whatever that is, right? Like I think it's a great depiction of that. So
yeah, there was like that scene in season one when he's trying to invest in that company with the art buyers, I guess.
Yeah, yeah.
And he buys the cool sneakers and is like so self-conscious showing them off. Like, that's Kendall to a T. Yeah. How much he's just desperate to fit in wherever he goes.
Indeed. So a lot more stuff happens with Shiv this episode, right?
Yeah, back to Shiv. So after Gil floats the chief of staff offer, she checks in with Logan that his offer was real. And it was. But in his conception, it's going to take several years worth of essentially apprenticing in his company before he will trust that she's ready to be CEO. And she's insulted and should be that Logan thinks she needs this much training when Roman is currently co-COO. But they do leave it on good terms, although she doesn't like 100% commit to going with his plan because it's going to be 3 years of her dicking around and like by his estimation, learning the business.
Here's how I see it. Come in. 6 months with Jerry, 6 months with Carl, Hong Kong for say another 12, Berlin or London, management training program for 6. Come back, spend 12 months alongside me, and when you're ready, I'll step aside.
Wow, Dad, that's a lot of months.
It's an appropriate amount of months.
Also, management training program? Roman COO, you have a toddler with a hard-on for chief operating officer, and I'm going through a management training program?
You're a young woman with no experience.
A woman, that's a minus.
Well, of course it's a fucking minus. I didn't make the world.
You make a small part of it.
If that doesn't work for you, what does?
That's a 3-year timeline.
Okay. So why don't you come in tomorrow and spend the day with me?
Oh, Jesus Christ, Dad.
What?
I need time. I haven't even told Tom yet.
Tell him.
And there's Gil. I have a job. I can't just come running to you.
What is it, Siobhan? Too slow or too fast? Because I'm fucking confused.
Dad, I want this. It's just about the process.
Okay.
This scene was a little rough to watch for me because I feel like I conceived of it as almost like a job interview, right? Mm-hmm. Or you've been offered the job and like you're given the opportunity to dictate the terms on which you will accept it. And
yep.
I just feel like Shiv's enthusiasm for it was a little lacking.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if I was applying for this job, I would be much much more willing to like sacrifice things in my current, because this is like one of the largest jobs, probably the largest job you'll ever be offered in your whole life.
Of course, yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, the idea, oh, but what about I got to go to this rally on Wednesday. It's like, dude, you know, you got to start making some sacrifices here. And I don't know that she fully grasped that. But one of the things that I also found interesting about the scene was that Logan is saying, here's 15 things you need to do before you can ascend the throne. Felt yeah. very similar to his speeches to Kendall in season one, right? That he's just kind mm-hmm. of putting this thing off into the future where he doesn't need to deal with it because ultimately Logan wants to be in charge.
Yeah, totally. And I wonder, I mean, you called it in the last episode where you were like, there's a lot of space. He's given himself a lot of outs.
Yeah.
In terms of when, like just by saying, and when you're ready, you will be CEO. Like, well, who decides? He decides. And that's the reminder of the scene, you know, in terms of where she is with regard to him.
Yeah. Yeah.
But
he's just thrown up all these obstacles. So,
yeah,
we'll see how that plays out. But mm-hmm. at this point, it still seems as though she is on a glide path to take this over. And of course, I was very curious how this would go over with Tom.
Yeah, so Shiv then finally comes clean to Tom about Logan's now week-old offer to come in at Waystar. It's established that it's been a week since they were in the Hamptons. So he's dismayed both that she has waited this long to tell him and that it's an alteration of the plan. He says they both had for him to become CEO someday, which, you know, was fine, I guess, when she thought she was in politics and would never be brought in. But she distracts him from his questions with sex. And the next night they have dinner at Roman and Tabitha's, in part, it seems, so that the watchful Roman can ask Shiv if Tom is lined up to succeed Logan. Because if not, Roman thinks he's got it all sewn up. And she like openly snorts the idea that Tom is going to be assembled, is going to ascend the throne. But perhaps because Shiv finds this idea so hilarious, she is extra caustic over the soup course at dinner.
Where do you buy your suits, by the way, Tom? Like, maybe that's why I'm just not moving as fast as you. I just don't have that, like, boxy corporate look. Right? I mean, I'm sorry, but, like, what the fuck? You look like a transformer. Like, what's wrong with your body, man?
Wrong, come on. There's nothing wrong with his body. It's just it's fucking suits. What? Come on, we've laughed about it before.
You have?
Yeah. He's thrifty and he has the worst taste in suits.
Totally has terrible taste. You look like a divorce attorney from the Twin Cities.
It's partly the walk. It's like a real...
robot?
Agricultural walk.
agricultural walk.
You know, I tried to get one of his suits tailored by the guy that Dad uses, but he just looks so
Shiv, fuck off.
I will say, I think one thing that is kind of triggering to me is you're triggered by all the digital media stuff.
And
I'm triggered at the fact that she clearly has so little respect for Tom. You know, I mean, I am very fortunate to be in a relationship with someone who we have lots of mutual respect. But like when one person in the partnership doesn't have respect for the other person, it's like very you just know it's not headed for a good place. And we see that manifest itself both when she like snorts, as you said, but also over dinner itself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And when he slaps back at her this way, like she can't stop laughing. She's beside him. So he's not looking directly at her, but like Tabitha and Roman can both see her face when she's basically like cracking up at his reaction. And so I wonder like, what is this? What is this reaction? What does it mean that she loves it so much that he hits back? And is like, is it triumph that he made him lose his composure? Is it a satisfaction that he's not letting her bulldoze him? Is making men angry her kink? I'm curious.
It's interesting. I didn't interpret it as any of those. I actually just thought it was nervous laughter. I thought it was
really?
Oh, yeah. It was like, I've gone too far. Like, and now things are extremely awkward. But
I don't think she was nervous at all. That was, to me, she was like, I did it, you know?
Mm. Mm. Interesting. I'll have to revisit the episode and check that out.
Yeah. Well, I also think it's noteworthy that Tabitha, who's Roman's girlfriend, played by Caitlin Fitzgerald, she perfectly clicks with Shiv and Roman's nasty, teasing tone.
Yeah, she fits right in. She fits right into the family, and I think it's possible she's going to become a bigger part of Roman's life in the future.
I mean, an actress of that stature, she's done a lot of work on TV. If you look her up, you've probably seen like 5 shows that she's done. So I do think that she has more stuff coming for her in the story.
No pun intended, of course, Tara, because you said she has more stuff coming, because in this episode, she also does reference the sexual encounter that she and Tom had in season 1.
Right.
In a very clever, oblique way, I thought.
Yes.
Which yes, that was a great joke, because it completely relies on you having watched season 1 to understand it. Like, they don't even explain.
We should say what it is. So they show up at the Shiv and Tom show up. He's got a scarf on. Shiv, very meanly in her way, says he has a cold and he wants to make sure everyone knows. And so when Roman and Shiv have gone outside, then Tabitha says, "You should swallow something, like honey."
Yeah.
It's like, ooh, right.
It is a reference to the season 1 episode, I think episode 7, when they go to that nightclub and Tom meets her and she fellates him and then takes his ejaculate and feeds it back to him, I believe.
Right.
Is probably the most clinical way I could describe it.
Yep.
So, yeah, I think that was clearly something meant to get his goat, as it were, when she says that in this episode. Because saying, like, you should swallow something, that's not really that's like not a normal syntax, I don't think.
No, it's not.
Okay. I'm glad we agree on that.
So back to Shiv. The next day, she gets too salty, no pun intended, given what we were just talking about, with Gil, and either quits or get fired, depending on who you ask. So she ends the episode by calling Logan and telling him to start looping her in. So she's committing to him.
A lot of great moments in this whole sequence. One question I have for you is, she kind of decides to leave the Evis campaign. There's debate on whether she's fired or quits. But did you think that this was a spur of the moment decision, or was it a calculated move? Like, when she said, "Do you want some Purell?" Did she know that it would lead to this ending? What do you think?
Yeah. So what happens is, they're walking down the street. Someone, a stranger, recognizes Gil. Gil, he's excited about Gil's candidacy, and Gil shakes his hand. And when they get in the car, Shiv offers him Purell, and then kind of mocks him about, like, when was the last time you actually touched a plebe? And I think that's a reference to, it seems like he's possibly getting into the pocket of big donors who are offering him like planes and stuff to use on the campaign.
Right.
And to me, I feel like it was partly like, that's just how she talks. Like, she kind of forgot herself, I think.
Yeah.
Or she got so comfortable because of the chief of staff offer that she thought, oh, I can relax now. And I can be sassy with Gil and get away with it.
Mm.
And then when he called her on it and said he didn't think that that was appropriate, I feel like she didn't want to stay anywhere where she had been dressed down, because Nate is also in the car and he hears all this, and this puts him back on top because he's, you know, says, you need a banana and a nap. And I feel like for Shiv, when that happens, she's like, I'm not staying here. Bye-bye. That was my read on it. That yeah. she couldn't stand to stay once she'd been bested like that.
Yeah. And I think this is a great moment after when she's talking with Logan on the phone too, right? Like Logan, mm-hmm. Well, you know, let's get to the end of the episode and let's talk about that. But
okay, yeah. So she's in a much better position than Kendall, who has given Greg the gift of a free, stunning apartment that Kendall has bought as one of a package that to flip. He's going to live in one and then flip the rest. It's 5 units, I think he said. And then so Greg can live in this place for free as long as until it's time to sell it.
And
but then
genuine, like, touching, heartwarming moment there when Greg realizes that, you know, Kendall is giving him this apartment. And yeah, it's just like, hey, these people, like, the scraps from their table can make a huge yeah. difference to people's lives, right?
I mean, it's heartwarming in the sense that it makes Greg happy, but at the same time, it's like Kendall's only giving it to him because he doesn't care. Like this, as you say, the scraps from his table, like this unit has so little value for Kendall
yeah.
that it means nothing to him to grant it to Greg, you know? So it cuts both ways, I guess. But anyway, it definitely cuts both ways because Kendall then makes Greg throw a party for a bunch of people Greg doesn't know. And that Kendall will not ask to leave so that Greg can go to sleep. Kendall also states that he is looking for pussy like a fucking techno Gatsby, which, if that's what he's saying to women, maybe why he hasn't found any yet. Mm. Bad line.
I have to change my pickup lines now, Tara, but yeah.
I mean, whatever works. Who knows? You are in Seattle. Maybe that does work there.
Yeah. No, but I would say so.
But the following day, Logan congratulates Kendall for cutting 476 heads at Valter. And his reward is having Kendall move into Logan's gigantic office and basically run point on the proxy war from there so that there aren't any miscommunications. And the last we see of Kendall, he's popping into a bodega to buy cigarettes and also to steal batteries for sport and immediately throw them away. And I won't go so far as to say I feel bad for Kendall because, as I have said, he's done all of this to himself. But I will say watching him really stresses me out.
So there's so much to dig into in these final scenes that you discuss. One of them is there's this moment when Shiv calls Logan and she says, hey, Dad, I quit my job. I'm going to pursue this CEO thing full time now. And he says, that's great. You know, and then he turns around to face Kendall because I think he conceives of Kendall as being a potential successor again.
Yeah.
Like, that was my read on the situation because Kendall did a good mm-hmm. job, right?
Yeah. Yeah. He pitted Kendall and Roman against each other and Kendall won. So now he potentially can pit Kendall against Shiv
right.
and let them battle it out.
And what's interesting is that this is actually the show I thought we would be watching in season one.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I actually thought Succession season one would be, hey, here's all these siblings. They're all going to vie for control and one of them is going to win. But really, that's not what season one was about. Because
yeah.
I think in the premiere is when Logan Roy has his health issue.
Yep.
Right? And then like it's very much about like the consequences of that. And then really it's Kendall's story. It's really about like Kendall trying to take control and then failing and then trying to take control again.
Yep.
The others aren't really that much in contention. Like certainly not Shiv and Roman yep. barely, you know. Mm-hmm. So now it's like we have a good old fashioned bake-off going on
yeah.
between Kendall and Shiv. And that actually really excites me because mm-hmm. that's what I was thinking the show might be at the beginning.
Yeah.
Then there's a scene at the end where Kendall buys cigarettes, steals battery, and then throws them away. And it honestly reminds me of when you're watching a horror movie like Eli Roth's Hostel or something like that. And you think to yourself, like, who thought this shit up? Like, what sick mind could have created the images that I've seen in Hostel? That's how I feel mm-hmm. about the idea of billionaire Kendall Roy stealing batteries from a bodega and throwing them in the trash. It is both brilliant and also I'm scared of the mind that conceived of it.
Yeah.
What did you make of that final sequence when he, like, takes the batteries and throws them away?
Yeah, I mean, it's like when you hear about people who self-harm, that they do it just to feel something
yeah.
or to feel something other than the pain they're feeling. And that's what this was to me. This is like, a version of self-harm for Kendall. Not that he really thought he was going to get caught. And if he did, like, obviously there would be zero consequences for him probably. But, you know, this was his way of like feeling a thrill, feeling like he got away with something. And then the thing he steals, like, he doesn't even want it, you know?
You know who Kendall reminds me of? I just realized it is I think you didn't really keep up with Game of Thrones as far as I recall, but he does remind me of Theon Greyjoy, a.k.a. Reek. I don't know if you know that character.
Sure.
Basically,
Alfie Allen,
that's right. He's basically a character that had been tortured so extensively that he no longer possessed any free will. Like he was completely in thrall of his captor. And that's what Kendall reminds me of. Like, he doesn't seem like he has any autonomy at this point. He is just doing whatever his dad says. And he is not incompetent at it. You know, he is somewhat skilled at it. And we'll see where that leads him. But it is chilling to watch him go through all these motions with seemingly no human emotion whatsoever. Right.
It's really rough. It's really, really rough.
Let's get to winners and losers of the week. Every week on The Sweet Smell of Succession, we choose a winning Roy, a losing Roy, a winning non-Roy, and a losing non-Roy. So this week, winning Roy. Who is your winning Roy this week, Tara?
I mean, I'm going to say Logan, the puppet master. He got everyone to do exactly what he wanted. He including Kendall, made him kill his own baby at Valter.
Yeah.
So
he struggled so hard for. That he now needs to gut. Good choice. Logan Roy as the winner. I actually chose Kendall as my winning Roy. And the reason is because he went from being so, I mean, like, I don't know if you remember all the various insults that were thrown at Kendall by his siblings last week. But, you know, they were saying, oh, you know, dad's just going to use you up and spit you out and like all these horrible things. And it's like maybe his fate is slightly different than that. You know, maybe he has better things in store for his future than just being used up and churned out and forgotten. Right. That is a big, like, so in real terms, it's not that big of a jump in status, but in, you know, emotional, metaphorical terms, he's quite a far distance from having no hope in the family. So,
I would dispute that the idea that being closer to Logan constitutes winning for Kendall right now.
That's fair enough. We'll see. I'm very curious if Kendall's going to end up dead at the end of the season. I think it's possible, but we'll find out. All right. Losing Roy. Who is the losing Roy of this episode? Tara.
Well, for the reason I just said, I'm going to say Kendall, so we don't need to relitigate it.
You just did this just to spite me.
We are divided. We're on opposite sides of a wide divide this week.
All right. In terms of my losing Roy, I say Roman. Because he started off in Logan's good graces, ended getting shut out of the room where it happens, right?
Yes,
ended,
he did.
Being deprioritized in favor of Kendall, who is now handling the proxy battle with Logan. So
yes, he is not the favored baby boy anymore.
Indeed. All right, so that's my losing Roy. Winning non-Roy. Winning non-Roy. I actually think we both agree on this one, right?
We do, yes. Nate. Nate has vanquished Shiv due to her own big mouth, possibly, on the campaign.
I think it was really brutal the way Shiv described Nate's speech. Her speech had the characteristics of not being shitty, was how she described the speech that wasn't Nate's. So
yes. Mm-hmm.
And now, seemingly by accident, or by dint of Shiv's loose lips, he is back in a positive position. So.
Yep.
Definitely the winning non-Roy this week. How about losing non-Roy, Tara?
Oh, poor Lawrence. Poor Lawrence.
Yeah?
So it's hard for Lawrence because his employees had no protections. They're now out of work. And, you know, even if he personally got paid, he hired them and he cares about them, presumably. And it's an awful thing for him to go through along with them. And on this, I should add, when I was talking before about what it's like when publications are under attack by the media barons that own them, I was looking at it from the perspective of a worker, but I should say I have been an owner/publisher as well. obviously on a vastly smaller scale. But when I founded a site called previously.tv in 2013, we were entering an extremely challenging media landscape then. We had a hard time getting our stuff to break through. We also tried a bunch of different stuff. We also did a pivot to podcasts, though not to video. And we ultimately had to shut down, even though we were running a lot leaner than Valter, didn't have any beehives or oat milk or whatever else Roman thinks is ridiculous that of their affectations.
I think you bought too much kale is what I heard. No,
we were kale heads. That is true. I just wanted to acknowledge that I've been on both sides of the situation, though. I mean, I hope the people that we worked with know that when we made the decision to shut down, it was hard. Not capricious like it was for, you know, both Roman and Logan as they're portrayed in this episode. And we didn't have a Kendall on the other side ready to spend $50 million to keep it afloat, but unable to argue more vigorously because he just killed someone. There are a lot of differences in our situation, but yeah, it's hard. It's a hard time to be in media. I mean, harder still this week, you know.
Yeah.
Just hard all the time.
You've been on both sides, both as like a worker and a proprietor, and it's not easy on either side. And particularly for a small outfit such as yours, you know, you didn't have VC backing or like much VC backing. You're very bootstrapping, right? You run very lean. And sometimes
we should say it's past tense. We did eventually, we shut it down last year.
And the economics are just punishing. And I think this episode if not really explores, at least shows the impact of what happens when the economics are really punishing.
Yeah, but the question, I mean, you know, I was visiting my parents last week and my mother was asking me like what I think is the future for media, like as if I fucking know. I have no idea. And the depressing answer is like it sort of feels like you have to hope for benevolent billionaires who are just willing to be patrons of the arts, essentially.
Yeah.
Which is an incredibly depressing answer to have to give, but like I don't know a better answer, and that's awful.
Yeah, I mean, not only is it a depressing answer on a principled standpoint, but there's just not that many billionaires out there willing to do that. You know, it's like a very small number that are willing to do that.
And even if you do, I mean, how do you whether a billionaire can be ethical is like a whole other question. You know, every billionaire is a policy failure, they say. But, you know, you can't always trust that they're going to go in it with altruistic motives and be able to maintain perfect separation. Yes, impartiality, exactly. Whether even if that's their intention going into it, eventually self-interest takes over, which is, you know, ultimately I think what this whole show is about.
Do you like the episode? I thought it was pretty solid.
It was effectively made. It's hard to say I liked it.
Just because of all the digital media stuff bringing those memories
back. For PTSD reasons. Yeah. Yes, exactly. Yeah. But no, yes, very well made.
Fair. Completely fair. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, ultimately, I feel like if the episode is able to represent in a fair way how these layoffs go down, it is doing somewhat of a service, right? That like,
yes, hey, it felt extremely accurate in its brutality.
Excellent. Well, those are our thoughts on this episode of Succession. And this episode was edited and produced by me, David Chen, and Tara Ariano. You can find more episodes of the podcast at successionpodcast.com. Email us at successionpodcast@gmail.com. This episode was powered by Simplecast, the first and last word in podcast management and distribution. If you're looking to start a podcast of your own, check out Simplecast.com. They are a great option, and they are making this podcast possible. Tara, until next week, where can people find more of your work on the internet?
You can find me on Twitter at Tara Ariano, TaraAriano. And you can also hear me every week, Wednesdays on Extra Hot Great, the podcast about television, and on the Again With This podcast about Beverly Hills 90210 and Melrose Place.
And final, my stuff at culturallyrelevantshow.com, which is a weekly interview podcast that I do with very interesting and cool people around the internet like Tara.
Hey.
Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.